And this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Australian Prime Minister alleges a cover-up at the MH17 crash site. Kerry is in Cairo for talks with Egypt and Arab League officials on Gaza violence. The U.S. and U.N. denounce ISIL persecution of Iraqi minorities.
These are abominable acts. We are very clear that they only further demonstrate ISIL's mission to divide and destroy Iraq.
Will Afghanistan go the way of Iraq? And the IAEA says Iran has turned its enriched uranium into a less harmful form. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Australia's Prime Minister is alleging a cover-up amid tampering of evidence at the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 crash site in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia's ambassador to Malaysia denies the crashed plane's black boxes were opened before they were handed over to Malaysian officials. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has details from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says Russia's President Vladimir Putin has so far been as good as his word by approving a UN Security Council resolution guaranteeing safe access for international monitors at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. But Mr. Abbott, speaking to reporters in Canberra, complains about what has been happening amid the bodies and wreckage before investigators arrived. He describes the most recent video from the scene as looking like a building demolition.
After the crime comes the cover-up. What we have seen is evidence tampering on an industrial scale. And obviously, that has to stop.
Malaysian officials have taken possession of the downed plane's cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. They were handed over by pro-Russia separatists who control the area where the Boeing 777 came down in pieces last Thursday. All 298 people aboard died. Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak negotiated directly via telephone with a rebel leader to arrange the handover of the aircraft's so-called black boxes. He also says the agreement includes releasing all human remains and full access to the site by an international team.
Only then can the investigation into MH17 truly begin. Only then can the victims be afforded the respect they deserve.
A White House spokesman reacting to the Malaysian leader's active engagement with the separatists in Ukraine called it entirely understandable considering the circumstances. Malaysia lost 44 citizens on the plane. The Netherlands had 198 of its citizens on the plane. At least 27 Australians were on the flight. Those countries are joining the United States and Ukraine in blaming the crash on a surface-to-air missile fired by separatists in eastern Ukraine. The degree of Russia's responsibility and involvement in a possible cover-up are being intensely discussed in the diplomatic and intelligence communities. Russia's ambassador to Malaysia, Ludmila Vorobieva, on Tuesday denied any such involvement of her government or that of the separatists.
The rebels do not possess any defense systems that are capable of shooting a plane at the altitude of 10 kilometers. They do not have this kind of systems. Russia has never supplied this kind of system.
The ambassador says the West is playing games, blaming someone and accusing some parties without any evidence. After the ambassador's remarks to reporters, several hundred protesters organized by the youth wing of Malaysia's largest political party gathered outside the Russian embassy. Placard-waving demonstrators chanted, "We want justice." The downing of Flight 17 is the second tragedy this year for Malaysia and its flag carrier. Its Flight 370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing vanished on March 8th after veering far off course, and no trace of it has been found. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in his continuing effort to resolve the crisis in Gaza, has been holding talks in Cairo with Egyptian and Arab League officials. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns is traveling with the American official and spoke with us from the Egyptian capital.
Secretary Kerry met this morning with the Egyptian Foreign Minister al-Shukri and the Arab League Secretary General al-Arabi. In both of these meetings, U.S. officials are really trying to figure out, you know, where the status of this Egyptian proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza lays. As you know, the Egyptian plan last week for a ceasefire in Gaza was rejected by Hamas. So the question now is, how can this be different? How can Hamas be brought into the situation so that they would agree to the ceasefire? Egypt is in a somewhat different position than it was when the last ceasefire in Gaza was concluded in 2012, largely because then, you'll recall, Mohamed Morsi was the president of Egypt, who had quite close relations with Hamas. The current Egyptian president, the former general Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, clearly does not have the same relationship with Hamas. So the question is, can Secretary Kerry, through the Arab League, through Qatar and Turkey, perhaps, help create the conditions for those with influence with Hamas to bring them into this?
Do we know why Hamas rejected the last Egyptian peace proposal?
Hamas leaders who rejected that proposal said they did so in part because it did nothing to address the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza. A senior State Department official traveling with Secretary Kerry said that, recognizing that, there may be some talk of border controls in the new push for a ceasefire. While this Egyptian president doesn't have as good a relationship with Hamas, certainly, as Mohamed Morsi, General al-Sisi's control of the Rafah border crossing between Egypt and Gaza certainly does give him some leverage. That's a crossing that Hamas wants open, and if they want that, they're going to have to deal with the Egyptians.
Is there any sign that Israel would agree to that?
The Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt is a security concern for Israel, but certainly if it were part of a broader arrangement, it's possible that the Israelis might be willing to go along with that. I think the question, the ceasefire question regarding Israel at this moment is, have these Israelis satisfied themselves that they have in hand this situation with the tunnels under the demarcation between Gaza and Israel? It's unlikely that Israel will agree to stop its offensive until it feels that it has satisfied its security concerns about those tunnels. And Israel itself has admitted that it has found more tunnels there than it thought were there before this operation.
So you think this may continue until they're satisfied that those tunnels are not working anymore?
Or until someone brings sufficient pressure to bear on them that this has gone on long enough.
VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns in Cairo, Egypt. The United States and UN Security Council have denounced the persecution of Iraqi minorities under the control of radical Sunni militants of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which seeks to create a caliphate across parts of Iraq and Syria. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the condemnations followed the issuance of a decree by ISIL that Christians and other non-Muslims under its control must convert to Islam, pay a special tax, leave, or face execution.
U.S. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf Monday denounced ISIL's declaration Saturday, which impacted Christians as well as Shia Muslims, Yazidis, and Shabaks. Many have fled the northern Iraqi city of Mosul and surrounding towns.
We condemn in the strongest terms the systematic persecution of ethnic and religious minorities by ISIL. We are particularly outraged by ISIL's recent announcement that Christians in Mosul must either convert, pay a tax, leave, or face execution in the coming days. These are abominable acts. We are very clear that they only further demonstrate ISIL's mission to divide and destroy Iraq. They have absolutely no place in the future of Iraq. We could not be more clear.
Late Monday, the UN Security Council issued a unanimous declaration denouncing what it calls the systematic persecution of individuals from minority populations and those who refuse the extremist ideology of ISIL and associated armed groups. The Council says such attacks may constitute a crime against humanity for which those responsible must be held accountable. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation Monday also condemned ISIL for what it calls the forced deportation of Christians under the threat of execution. thus further tearing apart the social fabric of the Iraqi people. OIC Secretary General Iyad Amin Madani condemned what he called the terrorist group and said such atrocities contradict the principles of the OIC that call for the entrenchment of a culture of tolerance and affinity among all nations and peoples. Hundreds of Christian families left Mosul, where they once numbered in the tens of thousands, and traced their presence back some 1,400 years. The group Open Doors, which monitors the persecution of Christians around the world, says while some families chose to stay and pay the tax, those who fled were sometimes stopped at checkpoints by militants and had their money, jewelry, mobile phones, and medicine confiscated. According to Patriarch Louis Sacco, a senior Christian cleric in Iraq, many Christians from Mosul are fleeing to the autonomous region of Kurdistan. Greg Barton of the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University says those Christians who remain under ISIL control will be vulnerable.
We've seen creeping persecution of Christians across the Middle East by hardline bullies, with governments not doing enough to stand up and face it. But now this has reached a peak in ISIL's caliphate.
Barton says while the international condemnation will have no impact on ISIL, it may serve other purposes.
It'll help those voices in Baghdad calling for a new Iraqi government to take a more principled position, and it should make it easier for Christians fleeing Mosul and other towns in the north to find sanctuary in Baghdad. But unfortunately, the last decade has seen a lot of Christian persecution in Baghdad, so one can imagine a lot will simply be fleeing the country if they can.
Barton says it will be up to ISIL's leadership to decide whether to chart a less radical course over the territory and people it now controls. He says that could help it consolidate support among more moderate Sunnis. Otherwise, he says a harsher form of Sharia law could turn the populace against it. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Catherine Powell, a fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, has been examining the future of Afghanistan after U.S. troops totally withdraw. She's concerned that the nation should not become another Iraq. We asked her in what way.
Well, with Iraq, we see Obama coming into office was right to try to draw down our involvement, our military's involvement overseas, because it had been quite taxing, and the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a fool's errand to begin with. But as we've seen with Iraq, with now the rise of ISIS, the self-proclaimed Islamic State, the Iraqi authorities weren't strong enough to prevent these insurgents from coming to power in some areas of Iraq. We could see the same thing in Afghanistan if the U.S. pulls out too quickly without adequately ensuring that the Afghan security forces are strong enough to prevent insurgencies like the Taliban insurgency from taking control. So my cautionary note there is that Obama, in undertaking this withdrawal from Afghanistan, take measures to ensure that the Afghan authorities are strong enough. And if we need to extend the deadline of U.S. involvement beyond December 2016, then we should, to make sure that Afghanistan doesn't become the next Iraq.
How about the international community stepping in where the U.S. is stepping out?
Well, the international community, NATO, follows the U.S. lead. And so the international community, including NATO, needs to be our partners and needs to take responsibility. But the U.S. has to show leadership for the international community, and we can't assume that the international community will fill a vacuum if Obama undertakes a hasty withdrawal. We saw with the deal that Secretary of State John Kerry brokered in the disputed presidential election in Afghanistan to get the parties to agree to a recount of all the votes, that the U.S. remains an indispensable nation, particularly where our interests are at stake. So U.S. leadership continues to be tremendously important, and whether we like it or not, the U.S. has to lead the way to bring other partners, including our international partners, to the table under our leadership.
Catherine Powell, a fellow for Women in Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Iran has converted its stockpiles of enriched uranium into a less dangerous format that is more difficult to use for nuclear weapons, according to the United Nations Atomic Energy Agency. The move complies with an interim deal reached with Western powers on Iran's nuclear program last year in exchange for easing of sanctions. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has converted its stockpiles of 20% enriched uranium into less dangerous forms. The enriched fuel could be used to make nuclear weapons. Tehran denies that it is trying to make bombs and insists the program is for civilian use. Iran and Western powers agreed Saturday to extend until November, a deadline on reaching a long-term agreement on the future of the nuclear program. But that remains a long way off, says International Institute for Strategic Studies analyst Mark Fitzpatrick.
They were able to agree to cap the sanctions, to cap the enrichment program, but Iran would not agree to roll it back to make any reductions, and that was the sticking point.
Speaking Saturday after the two sides agreed to extend the deadline, EU Foreign Affairs Chief Catherine Ashton admitted there is much work ahead.
While we've made tangible progress on some of the issues and have worked together on a text for a joint comprehensive plan of action, there are still significant gaps on some core issues which will require more time and effort.
Ashton is due to step down from her EU role before the end of the year, potentially complicating future negotiations. Mark Fitzpatrick is sceptical that any deal can be reached in the next 4 months.
But in the meantime, Iran's program is capped. They're not going to get any closer to being able to develop a weapon. And of course, they say that's not the purpose anyway. So diplomacy has been working. The program has been capped. We don't have a solution. We're not likely to have a solution. In 4 months, maybe we have to reassess and cap and extend it again.
In return for Iran converting its stockpiles of 20% enriched uranium, the United States will unfreeze $2.8 billion of Iranian assets, but sanctions against Iran remain in place. For now, the commitment to negotiations is being welcomed on both sides, says Iran sanctions and trade expert Nigel Kushner of W Legal.
I've got a number of clients who are desperate to jump back into the very profitable business relationships they had hitherto in Iran. And my message to them today is you can't reconduct business, but certainly by all means get on with your marketing, fly over, conduct meetings, discuss deals you might be able to do in a legitimate manner, of course, once the sanctions are lifted.
Western powers and Iran have yet to decide when and where the next rounds of talks will take place, saying only they would happen in the coming weeks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Delegates to the 20th International AIDS Conference are assembled in Melbourne, Australia for speeches, seminars and meetings to examine the current state of AIDS research. About 12,000 delegates, including scientists, activists and people living with the disease, will meet through Friday to discuss community responses to HIV and AIDS and ways to accelerate prevention and treatment. In conjunction with the Melbourne Conference, VOA is presenting a special series of reports that take a global yet personal look at AIDS. In today's report, we start here in Washington by following Christian Page Bass, a young gay HIV-positive man who at first had fears about seeking treatment. Today, he encourages other gay men in the city to seek health services.
You got it.
I really love to sing. I think God gifted me with a talent to be able to use my voice to sing.
Christian Page Bass also likes to raise his voice with a message of inclusion.
We don't like to call ourselves a gay church. We call ourselves radically inclusive. Look, we have transgender and we have straights or heterosexuals as well that attend the church. But I love it.
But the small town in North Carolina, where Christian grew up, was far from inclusive. In the southern U.S., conservative values are strong.
Didn't know what gay was, because the word gay was never used. The word mainly was faggot. That was the word. I didn't know anything about gays. When you're going to be a faggot, it's not you're going to be gay, you're going to be a faggot. Or you are a faggot. And I don't like that town.
In 2001, both Christian and his mother, an intravenous drug user, were diagnosed as HIV positive.
I
Thank you.
You're welcome.
When she died 5 years later of complications from AIDS, Christian was gripped with fear.
I looked on the dresser, and she had already started doing her pill box for the next week. And I looked at those pills, and I remember thinking, this is going to be the death of me. And from that day forward, I didn't want to take any more pills.
In need of a change of scenery, he decided to visit some friends in Washington, D.C.
I came to D.C., and I loved it. I seen all the gay people. I just was like, I want to stay.
The big question is always, have you missed any doses in the last 3 months?
A change of scenery also changed his views of his treatment. He met Justin Goforth, a nurse practitioner at the Whitman Walker Clinic.
He was really resistant to the idea of starting treatment for HIV.
It recently broke.
I think that he had a lot of really emotional baggage around his mother dying of HIV and the huge number of treatment and pills, really, that she was taking when she died, and now has become an advocate for people being on treatment.
Christian's advocacy has made him a regular on Washington's gay club scene.
Going to the club is work. I've had people come up to me and say, do you have a number, or do you have an email? How can I get in contact? I want to talk to you because I was just diagnosed, or I'm dating somebody that's positive. They're there for the moment, and then they're going, and they'll call me when they need me, or they'll text me when they need me. But, you know, we keep in contact.
Christian works as a part-time model.
When I got diagnosed and the doctor told me I had 2 years to live, I wanted to make sure people realized that you could take your medication and still be healthy and still look good and still be nice. You know, you can live long. You don't really see AIDS patients like you used to in the 80s. You use the word AIDS and everybody's running. You use the word HIV, people will stay. You use the word I'm positive and nobody's gonna move. But you use the word AIDS, it's like turning the lights on and the roach is running.
Christian continues to face his stigma head on and encourages other gay men to seek health services. Visit our website at voanews.com for more of our coverage of the AIDS conference in Australia and other personal stories such as Christian's. U.S. combat troops are withdrawing from Afghanistan on pace to leave the country by the end of this year. On Monday, President Obama honored a soldier whose actions were under fire in Afghanistan, earned him the Medal of Honor. Jeff Selden reports for VOA Television.
It was a brutal assault that's gone down as one of the bloodiest for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, a July 13, 2008 attack near the northeastern village of Wanat. Setting up at a new outpost, former Staff Sergeant Ryan Pitts and his fellow soldiers faced a pre-dawn onslaught from about 200 Taliban fighters.
Almost instantly, every one of them was wounded. Ryan was hit by shrapnel in the arm and both legs and was bleeding badly. Already, three American soldiers in that valley had fallen, and then a fourth.
President Barack Obama said the terraces near the outpost erupted, with more fire and grenades coming from the village itself. Pitts fought back, holding off the Taliban, helping to call in airstrikes, even as the attack claimed the lives of nine fellow soldiers.
It is remarkable that we have young men and women serving in our military who, day in, day out, are able to perform. With so much integrity, so much humility, and so much courage. Ryan represents the very best of that tradition.
The Battle of Wanat, as it came to be called, was not without controversy. The mother of Corporal Jason Bogar, who died in the attack, claimed the Army made huge mistakes, leaving her son, Sergeant Pitts, and the other soldiers needlessly exposed.
The Afghan villagers told them you're going to be attacked, and then the Predator drones were pulled the night before.
The Army has changed its tactics as a result. Pitts, now working for a software company, is the proud father of a one-year-old boy. Like the other Afghan war veterans to receive the nation's highest military honor, he says the medal does not belong to him alone.
The honor belongs to every man who fought at Vehicle Patrol Base Kaler, especially to those who made the ultimate sacrifice, allowing the rest of us to return home.
That medal now adorns his neck. As the president put it, a testament to his sacrifice the United States must never forget. Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On this date in 1587, the first of more than 120 people landed on an island called Roanoke on North Carolina's Outer Banks to establish the first English colony in the New World. Governor John White returned to England seeking supplies. When he returned 3 years later, the settlement was deserted and all of its inhabitants had disappeared. In 1822, Austrian monk Gregor Mendel was born. His scientific research became the basis of modern hereditary theory. In 1864, Union forces prevailed in the Battle of Atlanta during the American Civil War, inflicting heavy casualties on the defending Confederates and opening the way for a six-week siege of the Georgia city. In 1887, German Nobel Prize-winning physicist Gustav Hertz was born. His research in quantum physics advanced the study of the movements of free electrons in various gases. In 1934, federal agents killed notorious American gangster John Dillinger in Chicago. In 1946, the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, headquarters of the British military, was bombed by the Jewish group Irgun. Despite warnings, the British refused to evacuate. More than 90 people were killed in the attack. On this day in 1967, American writer and folklorist Carl Sandburg died. Sandburg is best remembered as a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Abraham Lincoln. On July 22, 1977, disgraced Chinese Communist Party official Deng Xiaoping was restored to positions of power and helped guide China toward modernization. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The federal government of Somalia has taken another step in joining the international community, appointing an ambassador to the United States and opening an embassy in Washington. Omar Abdirashid Ali Shamarki presented his credentials to President Obama in a ceremony at the White House on July 14th. The first Somali ambassador to the U.S. in more than two decades, his appointment represents the progress that his nation and government have made in recent years. Somalia's embassy in Washington closed in 1992 after the fall of its longtime president, Siad Barre. Years of clan and political infighting ensued, followed by a violent insurgency conducted by the al-Qaeda-linked militant group Al-Shabaab. Although with no formal diplomatic ties before 2012, the United States and others in the international community worked to end the crisis, providing millions in humanitarian aid and working to promote a stable government. Emerging from a four-year United Nations-backed transition plan in 2012, Somalia had its first elected government in 20 years. Ambassador Shamarki's arrival in Washington represents a further strengthening of U.S.-Somali relations. He is well familiar with America and served as Somalia's prime minister under the transitional federal government. With Somalia's emergence from more than two decades of conflict, expanding contacts has been a top U.S. priority. Last month, our government announced that the U.S. will soon name its own ambassador to Somalia, resident in Nairobi. With these two key diplomatic posts filled, our governments will be fully engaged advancing U.S. interests in the Horn of Africa and helping restore stability, peace, and security to Somalia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.